Hello, this is Scott Sykes, and I am pleased to welcome you to Voices from Appalachia, a new show that will feature oral histories from the Appalachian Oral History Project collection. This is a collection that was developed over several years, beginning in 1973, which sought to gather stories of lived experiences in this region, particularly in the area of Southwest Virginia. That collection is in the process of being digitized and curated in a publicly accessible online archive. This is work being done by Emory and Henry students, and I look forward to sharing many of those oral histories with you and to talking with community members and students about what we can learn and know about life here in this region as we listen to Voices from Appalachia. Well, I am pleased today to welcome Mary Lampkins into this conversation. The oral history that we're going to be listening to pieces of is from Robert Lampkins, who was recorded in January of 1973 and is related to Mary. And I'll let her tell us about that a little bit later. But Mary, welcome. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And to introduce yourself, can you just tell us a little bit about who you are and where you're from? And
as Scott just said, my name is Mary Lampkins, and Robert Lampkins, or Uncle Bob, is my uncle. I was born and raised right here in Washington County at the old Johnston Memorial Hospital on Valley Street. I went to Meadowview Elementary. I went to Virginia Highlands for a couple of years, but my dream was always to come here to Emory, and I did that twice, elementary education. And like I said, born and raised right here, I didn't stray too far from home.
Yeah. And you were a teacher in Washington County for how long?
Yes, for 32 years. I just retired right before COVID came along. I put in for retirement in 2019, that summer, and not knowing what was on the way. And my last day in a classroom with my students was Friday the 13th of March 2020.
Wow, how about that?
So,
well, again, I'm so glad you're here. This is one of my favorite items, or oral histories, I should say, in the collection. It's one that was featured in the book that came out of this project called Our Appalachia that was published in 1974, I believe, and is one that I often share with students. And there are a number of reasons why. And we're going to listen to pieces of this and talk about some specific issues. But to help our audience just kind of meet Robert Lampkins, your uncle, who you said you referred to as Uncle Bob, of course. Tell us about him. What would you like for us to know about Robert Lampkins and your memories of him?
What I remember about Uncle Bob from the time I was little is that he was always busy. Like he just, I don't ever remember him just like sitting down and relaxing. He was always like just doing something. He wasn't a very big person in stature. He was probably maybe 5'11", somewhere around there. And he wasn't real big at all, but he was just always just like doing something, just never still is what I remember about Uncle Bob.
He sounds like that, and he talks a lot about being busy. He seems like he was working constantly when you listen to this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did anybody in your family or Uncle Bob ever mention that he had participated in the Oral History Project?
I had heard about it, like, years ago, but I really didn't know what it was about. And, in fact, I didn't even know he was in that book until you had just mentioned it.
Yeah, they even include a picture of him in there that I showed you.
But no, I didn't know that.
When did you first find out about his involvement in it?
It was back when I want to say, I mean, it's pretty recent.
Okay.
Like years ago, I knew that he had done something, but I didn't know what it entailed.
Okay.
But then it was probably, I want to say, I was in a meeting with Tal Stanley about something, and he had mentioned it. And then he had, I'm on the watershed committee, and he had sent us a clip or a link so that we could listen to it. And that was just like maybe 3 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's pretty fresh in my mind.
Yeah, I'm glad.
When I first heard about it.
What were some things that just in general struck you about it the first time you listened to that interview with Robert Lampkins?
Well, the very first thing that I was surprised to find out is that he was in the military. I never knew that Uncle Bob was in the military.
How about that?
I mean, I just never knew that because he was out before I was ever born. And I guess nobody just ever mentioned that he had been in the military.
How about that?
So that was a big surprise to me.
Wow. Well, as you said, he is somebody who he strikes me as somebody who was an industrious person, always working. And he worked multiple jobs, he talks about in this interview. And I want to play our first segment of Robert Lampkin's, and we'll listen to multiple sections from this oral history and talk about them. But one of the reasons that this particular oral history is a feature of the collection, and it's one that I often share with students, is because he speaks with such a strong and stirring voice, I think, about his frustrations with what he saw as the limits that were placed upon him as a black man in this community and in the world. So I want to play this particular segment first, and he talks about going and purchasing the materials to build his home. And he talks about being real adamant about the fact that he wanted the best materials at a good price. He was willing to pay cash for those things. And then he talks in the piece that we're going to listen to here about some reactions he got from that. So let's take a listen to this first piece from Robert Lampkin's in 1973.
Well, that's when everything began to start looking up for me. Because the farmers that I had once worked for traveled this road here. They would run over in a ditch. They would turn around in their cars and look as if to say, what is that boy doing? That boy that these farmers speak of happened to be a Negro that has the desire to do, and will say no to nothing, will attack anything, regardless of how big it is or how small it is. Because I have learned from my 3 years in military service that can't do a thing. Man himself can, but you got to fight and fight hard. And when I speak in terms of fight, I don't mean to put up your fist and start swinging. I mean picking up a pick and shovel and getting down to the nitty gritty. Show the people that you can do, but don't tell them what you can do. Show them, because they will always, until a future date, say that that Negro can't do nothing. You have to show these people.
What thoughts do you have about that segment that we just listened to?
The number one thing is, like, people may have think that things have changed a lot, but when you are in this area in black skin, you see that things really have not changed an awful lot. Because, I mean, I still get looks about, you know, when I go into some place, or especially if I'm, like, dressed nicely and I'm in a place like Belk at the Pinnacle or something, like, people will still look at me if I'm looking at things I want to buy, like, what is she doing looking at that? I mean, and that is just the God's honest truth. It has changed some, but it's still, like, people still do that kind of thing. And it's so irritating, but, you know, at my age, you just learn to ignore them, and their problem is not my problem because I'm confident in who I am, and I know what I am and what I can do, and I've done it. So I just let them go ahead and think what they want to think.
I hear those similar things in what he's saying. That's what I hear in his voice in that.
Yeah, exactly. And that was in 1973.
Right.
And here it is 2024.
Right.
You know.
Right. At so many points in the conversation that Robert Lampkin's had with the person who was interviewing him that day, he wants to be very precise.
Exactly. Yeah.
He's very precise about dates and times in particular. And as somebody who knew him, What would you say that says about who he was, about his personality?
That he was a precise person. And I'm that way too. And I just, like, when I want to tell a story, I want the exact date. It's no around that time. I have to be exact. Mm-hmm. And for Uncle Bob's personality, like I said, he was a precise person. Like, he wanted things to be documented exactly the way they happened in the order that they happened. Because he was orderly. I mean, and he was just that way.
How else would you see that? I don't know how long you knew him. I guess I didn't ask that. How many years was he still alive that you knew him?
Let's see. He died in July of 2011, I want to say. I just said I was precise. So I think that's when it was, because I know that it was several years after my daddy passed away. So, yeah, it was in July of 2011, and I was born. Well, I'm not going to say what year I was born.
That's fine.
But I knew him, like, through my adulthood. Yeah, and he was always busy. Even after he retired, he was just always busy.
He was just
a busy person. And, like I said, what I remember the most about Uncle Bob is that he was just never still. Like, he was always doing something. Like, sometimes he would just be riding around in his field on his tractor. Like, he just had to be doing something.
Do you have any favorite stories about him or favorite memories of him in particular?
Well, yeah, he called me a special nickname, which I shall not reveal. But that's one thing that when I think about Uncle Bob, I can always hear him saying that to me. Like, I would be like, if I would walk up the road, he would be sitting on his porch and he would holler, "Hey," and use my nickname. And I would walk up there and we would chat a few minutes.
He has this particular cadence to his voice. And I don't know, I think one of the questions that I often think about when I'm listening to any oral history is that, you know, people know that they're doing that. I mean, he would have been sitting there knowing that he was doing this interview and it was being recorded. Maybe it was hard to conceive of, but he would have had some sense that down the road people would still be listening to this. And so I've often wondered, again, with any oral history, if people, I don't know, if they try to take a little more care with what they're saying in a situation like that.
And that would be Uncle Bob.
Okay.
Like, he would think ahead of time, and he would think, okay, this is recorded. Someone's going to be listening to this years down the road, so I need to make sure I'm speaking loud and clearly.
Right.
That's Uncle Bob.
Okay. So that was a question I was going to ask, because his voice, again, stands out amongst this collection for his precision in speech, his clarity in speech, that he clearly had given a lot of thought to this before the interview took place. And I just wondered if he was like that in general when you spoke to him in conversation.
Yeah. Yes, he was.
Okay.
He always spoke clearly. He always spoke in a tone so that he could be heard.
I got it.
Yeah, and I listened to this just a couple of days ago in its entirety, and I just sat there with my eyes closed, and I could just see Uncle Bob sitting there. He always sat, like, you know, with one arm up and his leg across, you know.
Much like this photograph that we'll have to get on the website.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how he always sat.
Do you know if the house he referred to in this interview that he built is where he always lived, or did he live elsewhere after that?
I think that might be the one where, because I know that but like I said, that everything, all of that happened before I was born, but I just always remembered that house even when I was just little. And I know that he had added on to it over the years, so I think that's probably the same house.
Probably.
And my aunt lives there. She still lives there now.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is his wife, Jerry.
Yes,
still
Geraldine.
Alive. Okay.
Yes, my Aunt Jerry.
Excellent. And that's on Indian Run Road out in the Blacksburg community.
It is.
Yeah, so one of the things that I often share is the first sort of minute to minute and a half of this interview when it began in 1973, because sometimes I think he's so clear in what he wants to say that I often have wondered if he might have even written down a good bit of what he says at first. as we've said, he has that particular way of speaking. He wants to be clear about everything he's saying. And so I have an example of that too, which I think is something we should listen to now.
This is a rural black community located just off of number 11 highway, 20 miles west of Marion, Virginia, 1.5 miles north of Emory Henry College, 11 miles east of Abingdon, Virginia. It's a rural black community known as a given name of Blacksburg, Virginia. Unknown date, but handed down from generation to generation, this community is one of the oldest black settlements in Southwest Virginia. So I've been told from older people that was the first founders of this community. I will name a few. Aunt Lily Gibbs died 99 years and 8 months, not to be exact, but close. Mr. Robert Hill Sr., 80-some-odd years. Miss Anna Foster, 80-some-odd years.
Yeah, I often share that in class. I just love the sound of his voice. I love the strength in his voice and what is conveyed about him and that community, I think, in just those first few seconds, the first minute and a half of that interview.
Yeah, and listening to that, it would not surprise me that Uncle Bob would not have written something down mm-hmm. to say, because he was just that type of person. He would want to make sure that he said what he needed to say, and he didn't want to leave out anything. So I could see him having something written yeah. ahead of time.
Do you think there were, in particular, things that he wanted to convey with this opportunity that day?
Do you mean about the whole?
Yeah, I guess maybe that's not a great question. I mean, clearly they talked about some very specific topics that, and I forget who did this interview.
I want to say George Stevenson.
Well,
maybe.
There's a little bit of lack of clarity there, because
yeah.
we don't hear in this interview anybody speaking, but in some of the other oral histories we do, and it's the students who were involved in that project who went out and interviewed people. But the other thing that gives this a little bit of lack of clarity is we have more than one interview with Robert Lampkins. So I think Dr. Stevenson went back and did some follow-up conversations with him.
Yes, I listened to that part too.
Okay,
yeah.
So I'm not exactly certain who did this day, but clearly they wanted to know about work that he
right.
had done. They wanted to know about his work at Olin and Reynolds and his work as an independent contractor. And they wanted to know about the Blacksburg community in particular. But I just feel like he was the kind of person who would have seen this as an opportunity to communicate some things that were important to him.
Right,
I guess
yes.
that's what I was asking about.
Yeah, and from knowing Uncle Bob and from listening to this, I know that he was so concerned with making sure that black people, not just himself, but just black people in general, were treated fairly and got what was like what they're entitled to,
mm-hmm.
which by no means am I saying just because you're black, you're entitled to this, that, and the other.
Mm-hmm.
But you shouldn't be like left out of something, which we were for hundreds of years.
Right. He just wanted simple fairness.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Did he talk about those things a lot, just in general in everyday life? Do you remember?
Not with me,
mm-hmm.
because of course, I mean, he would always, because everybody that knew me knew that I wanted to be a teacher.
Uh-huh.
That's all I wanted to do. And, you know, he would talk to me, and he had told me, you know, you can do this. You just do what you need to do, and you can do it.
Hmm.
You know, and I got that kind of encouragement from my parents and from anybody who knew that I wanted to be a teacher. But I'm the type of person that was I wouldn't have cared if somebody said, no, you're not going to do that. I would have said, stand back and watch.
Sounds like something he would have said.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, as I've said, it amazes me that even listening to this, he seemingly never stopped working, as you have
said. Never.
And he never stopped learning.
No, he didn't.
Mm-hmm. Education was really, really important to him. And he mentions it multiple times in this interview, seeking out education for himself through correspondence courses. He went to Florida for a time. And
that I didn't know either until I listened to the oral history.
He wanted to be as knowledgeable about as much as he possibly could, it seemed to me. And so he sort of had this powerful drive, this sort of uncompromising drive, I think, to prove himself, to make his life better. And so he valued education. He talks in here about wanting his children to go to college. Can you tell us what happened with them? What became of them? Did they indeed go to school?
I think that they both attended Virginia Highlands for a while.
I think he does mention that with his son in here later on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't know. I do know that his son is retired now.
Okay.
And his daughter, she currently works at the DMV.
Here? Are they both in the community still?
Yeah. His son lives in Johnson City.
Okay.
And his daughter lives right across from their mom.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Have they listened to this, or have you talked with them about this?
You know, Scott, I do not know. I don't even know if they know about this.
Hmm. Well,
so, I will definitely let his daughter know.
Yeah, yeah. I have a clip related to that, too, that I want to play. And this is the longest piece of the oral history that we'll listen to. And what Robert Lampkins eventually did was start his own business. Mm-hmm. And he talks at multiple points in here about what a struggle that was to get the financing for that. But he wanted to run equipment. He felt like he had a lot of experience and knowledge about that. And so he ended up doing that. And from what I understand, he would plow people's gardens and disc it up, but he would do grading work and things like that. Do you know much more about the work he did in that regard?
Well, I just know somebody was always calling him to go somewhere and do something. We just called it the big truck.
Okay.
Like it was the big, big truck. And he was just so busy.
Hmm.
And like he always, you know, was going to do something for somebody.
Well, let's hear this section where he talks about starting his own business.
Okay.
I'm wanting to go to school. And what I think that I will really enjoy doing, and what I really enjoy being around, is equipment. Heavy equipment. I told my wife one day, I says, Jerry, I says, I'm going to take me some kind of home study course, and maybe one of these days that I will be able to do my own work, be ready to go when someone calls me to do a job. Well, I went and borrowed some money from the local bank, and I bought me a little tractor outfit, tractor, plows, mower machine, and disc. I went over in Shady Valley, Tennessee, which lies southwest of Damascus, Virginia, about 13, 14 miles. I told the lady what I could pay her for what she had to sell. And she said, if you'll bring me cash money, say this yours. So I took her cash money, and I bought this outfit. I drove it in at night because I know from being around that if I didn't bring it in at night, the white man would condemn me before I even got the switch turned off. That's to keep the engine from running, which I was right. I bought this equipment stuff in at night and had papers to prove that I paid cash money for it. The next day, I had a telephone call from what I would consider my friend. This, I'm speaking in terms of a white man. Boy, what do you want? What do you want for that tractor you got sitting out in your yard? I said, money won't buy it, because I know what was taking place. I had something that I was not supposed to have in the white man's eyesight. That is something to compete with him. You, as a black man, are fine as long as you stay down where you belong. But when you get in position to where you are on the level with him as far as home and materials things are concerned, you are fine as long as you're down below him. But when you get up on that level with him competing with this white man, you are in for it. And I speak this to be the truth, and I'll lay my hand on the Bible swearing it's something I don't do. But this is the truth.
That is definitely, I think, one of the more powerful pieces in this oral history.
And yeah, you can hear so much frustration mm-hmm. in his voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's helpful for students to hear that.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's hard for the young people that I work with to consider the actual real lived impact of those systemic issues that he talks about. It's just something that is not apparent to them. And I think that's one of the powerful things of having these stories recorded. This is an ordinary person just over the hill from the college where mm-hmm. they're going, and they hear that frustration and hear his own lived experience with that. I invite you to join us again next week on Wednesday at 1:30 to hear part 2 of this conversation as we listen to Voices from Appalachia.